Welcome to How to Save Your Life. How to Save Your Life is produced with the assistance of the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Your host is Dr. Philip Stieg, Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Welcome to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and I have the distinct pleasure of being with Dr. Julia Sampton. Dr. Sampton is a practicing neurologist and psychiatrist in the New York City area. She is assistant director of the New York Headache Center, and she has an active private practice. How many of you have had headaches to the point that you can't function in daily life? Dr. Julia Sampton has the answer. There is hope. There is a cure. Your headache will go away. Stay with us. Welcome to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and I have the distinct pleasure of being with Dr. Julia Sampton. Dr. Sampton is an assistant director of the New York Headache Center and maintains an active private practice in psychiatry in the New York area. She's got a distinguished career in the management of patients with depression and headaches, and I am extremely happy to have you here with us this evening to talk about some of these things. Julia, could you explain to us, what a neurologist and what a psychiatrist does and how the two specialties work together in your brain?
Sure. And I just want to say thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here as well. So a neurologist is actually a physician that specializes in disorders of the nervous system. And generally these are what we refer to as physical disorders of the nervous system. For example, things like seizure, multiple sclerosis, headaches. Some people will experience symptoms such as numbness or tingling in their hands or feet. These are the kinds of things that you would seek the help of a neurologist for. A psychiatrist, on the other hand, is looking more at the emotional aspects of our lives, specifically mood and affect and the way that we think about things. So my area of expertise is both looking at the brain from a physical organ as well as looking at the emotions that make us human.
So that's a broad field. Big broad fields. Just a quick question. Are many people, double boarded in both neurology and psychiatry? Is it a common thing to do what you've done?
It's actually fairly uncommon. Because most people really tend to move towards one discipline or another philosophically and naturally select one specialty. I, however, was very, very interested in both sides of the human nervous system and really just wanted to pursue both. But it is unusual. There are a handful of us.
Just a handful.
Yeah.
So New York is blessed in having you here.
Oh, thank you. I don't know about that, but thank you.
So what particular things do you see in the office, and what do you like to deal with, your particular areas of expertise?
There are a few areas that I'm interested in. One of my areas of expertise is the treatment of headache, head pain. The reason why this falls under the rubric of what would be referred to as a neuropsychiatrist is because there is a very dynamic interplay between mood and stress and pain, particularly in headache. So it's a fascinating area. The other areas that I find very interesting would be things such as depression, anxiety. One of the things that I really love to treat is attention deficit disorder, because I think it's a really interesting marriage of a neurologic and psychiatric disorder. And I also will treat people that have difficulties with eating disorders or really just managing stress and anxiety in life.
Sounds like everyday life here. So let's.
It's smattering up.
So let's start with the most common thing. It seems to me that if there's a person walking in the streets that says they've never had a headache, they probably need a psychiatrist for another disorder.
Denial.
So we know they're common. I mean, how do you characterize headaches? I presume you classify them into a bunch of different categories.
That's right. So there are headache seemingly is a mundane disorder, but the truth is you're absolutely right. There are a few different types of headaches that physicians like to discriminate between. And actually, it can be very debilitating. And one of the reasons why I've enjoyed treating it is because people come to me and they're really not taken quite seriously by their physicians because it just seems like, you know, you have a headache. I mean, this is something that we all deal with, but actually some of them can be very debilitating. So the typical types of headaches that I see is migraine. That's the most common. And second, it would be tension headache. Most people think that tension headache is really secondary to you're just so stressed that you have a tension headache. But actually, it more so reflects muscle tension. But stress and anxiety can bring them on. And as I'm sure we'll talk about later, the impact of stress and anxiety on physical pain. And then there are other types of headaches, such as something called a cluster headache, another severe, very debilitating type of headache. And then there are headaches that are secondary to medical conditions. The headaches that I've just referred to really are headaches that are a result truly of a primary medical problem. In other words, they aren't because you have a problem within the brain, such as something like a tumor or a bleed or anything like that. They're in their own right, they are a disorder such as diabetes or what have you.
So, I mean, it's really a complex field. And I guess thinking about it from the patient's perspective, you know, I've got headaches. I go to my general doctor, and like you said, a lot of them get trivialized by the general doctor.
Right.
When does the patient have to start pushing and saying, you know, I really need to get to a neurologist? What are the particular characteristics of a headache that should lead to a visit with you?
Well, it's tough to say because oftentimes a general physician can treat headaches because they are pretty widely seen. But at the same time, if somebody is having headaches and it really seems to be more severe than what your general doctor can address, really would be perhaps beneficial to see a neurologist or even a headache specialist. I would also say that if your headache is disabling in ways that really seem to be interfering with your life and are not responding to medications that would typically treat headaches, it's important to seek neurological help. Oftentimes, people with migraines will come to see me because they are disabling and they can actually be pretty scary. So a migraine typically is a very severe headache and it's accompanied by other symptoms such as nausea and vomiting and sensitivity to light and sound and really makes someone feel quite miserable. And it's frightening enough that they will want to see a specialist even before they see their primary medical doctor.
I mean, so many times you hear somebody walk up and say, oh, geez, I have a long history of migraine headaches. Is that an overused term, you know, by the public? And you know, how do we help get them around it to really get to you?
Right. That's a great question. So we have a very strict definition of what a migraine headache is, although not everybody follows what the textbook definition of migraines are. From our perspective, we consider migraines to be exactly what I had described earlier, which is a headache that's generally one-sided, that is accompanied by nausea, vomiting, sensitivity to light and sound, and might get worse with physical activity, and generally lasts more than 2 hours. A lot of people will just say a very severe headache is a migraine. In reality, it isn't always. It can fall into some of the other categories that I discussed earlier. And if it doesn't have at least some of those classic symptoms, we really can't call it a migraine.
Mm-hmm. So how do we distinguish that then from, you know, these other categories you were talking about, like cluster headaches and tension headaches?
Right.
What's different about those?
Well, a tension headache is really, again, going to involve muscle tension. So oftentimes people will have lots of tension reflected as pain in the muscles of their neck and the muscles of their head. It almost feels like a vice-like pain where you might imagine a headband. And usually doesn't have the nausea and the vomiting and the severity of a migraine, although it can be quite a nuisance and can hang around for several days and really impact your quality of life nonetheless. A cluster headache is a very, very severe headache, and actually by some people it's been dubbed the suicide headache because the pain can be so severe that people really just want to take their own lives. It's been labeled that. It's really quite a serious condition in terms of the pain, but it's very treatable. And hopefully those folks get to us, you know, as quick as possible. I always try in my practice to see somebody with cluster headache on the day that they call because it really is just a bad place to be. This headache, though, even though it can be terribly severe pain, it actually usually only lasts for about 20 minutes at a time. And mysteriously, it occurs in clusters. So people will have a number of short, brief attacks that can last 3 to 4 weeks, and then miraculously they're fine. And sometimes people get the headaches continuously at the same time of year, year after year. So it's a little bit puzzling.
Is there anything genetic or familial, you know, running in family lines or behavioral that is related to these types of headaches?
Absolutely. There's a very strong genetic component. It's one of the first things that I will ask people about if they have a family history.
For all three types of those headaches, or?
Yeah, truthfully, yes.
So it runs in families.
It really does. It really does. It's always very sort of reassuring to me when I see a young kid with a migraine if they have had a family member with a migraine. Mm-hmm.
What do we do about medication? Are these pretty easily treated? Can we help people?
That is absolutely resounding. Yes, we can treat these people, and that's one of the reasons why it's so gratifying is because people come to me, they are miserable, and one of the few things in medicine that you can really fix. And the biggest group of medications are triptans, and those are medications such as Imitrex and Relpax, and those work to abort a headache. So if you have a really bad headache, you take one of these, your headache will feel better. For people that get so many headaches, we actually might put them on a daily medication to prevent their headaches from even occurring.
That, for me, was a loaded question. I don't know if you remember this, but I had actually sent my grocer to you, who you've cured. And now every time I go in, he just raves about you and the fact that his handicap has gone down 2 strokes. So he's living proof that these medications do work. Is there ever any kind of surgical therapy that's needed for these headaches?
Well, what I was trying to discuss earlier, although maybe it didn't come out to be quite so clear, is that when a migraine is really just a pure medical condition, or headaches are really not secondary to any sort of other process that can be occurring in the brain, really the answer is no. I mean, there are some experimental treatments such as vagal nerve stimulation for the treatment of migraines, but we're really just at the beginning. And actually, I will say that there's a few very interesting studies out right now that are examining the cause of migraine and relate it to perhaps a hole in the heart, which is sounds like a romantic notion, but it's actually a physical small hole in the heart that might allow a blood clot to pass through and pass up to the brain and set off a what we call a cascade effect, where it might create a headache. And we're looking at surgeries to close that heart that might prevent headaches. But again, that's all very experimental.
So by and large, most people with these disorders should be thinking about medical treatment for these things.
You got it.
Are they going to get better?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a joy to see, because people come to me and they think that they're really suffering and their lives have really suffered, and it's something that you can fix.
Well, that's great news for everybody. We're going to have to take a brief break. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. Julia Sampton to talk more about the management of headaches and other neurological and psychiatric disorders. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and again, I have the pleasure of being with Dr. Julia Sampton, a neurologist and psychiatrist in the New York area and assistant director of the New York Headache Center. Dr. Sampton maintains an active private practice in neurology and psychiatry in the New York area. Before the break, we were talking about the various types of headaches, and one of the questions I didn't have the chance to ask is, you know, are they more common in men or women?
They are definitely more common in women, although men are afflicted, but we do see them more commonly in women. And there are a few hypotheses as to why this could be true, but what we think is those silly hormones might be to blame, specifically estrogen. It's really fascinating because what we see along the life cycle is that oftentimes a woman will first present with headaches around the time of puberty when there are hormonal fluctuations. And then again, headaches can get much more severe around perimenopause when the hormones are bouncing all around. And we actually see them peter out after menopause. One is very common thing for me to see is people that have, or I should say women that have headaches during two times of the month or the menstrual cycle, once during their periods and another time during ovulation. And the reason being is that's when we see fluctuations of estrogen. So it's actually when we see estrogen go up and down that we see a headache. It's not so much the level of estrogen, because in menopause we see very low levels of estrogen and women don't have headaches, and around puberty we see higher levels of estrogen that again will go up and down, and that's when we see the headaches.
Through the conversation, we've realized that headaches are extremely common. You know, when does the patient need to be worried, and the treatment is extremely hopeful for a headache.
Right.
When does the patient need to be worried that, you know, this isn't just a headache, it's not a migraine, it's not a cluster headache, it's something more, you know, when do I need to get more testing?
Right. That's a great question. So essentially, there are a few red flags that we try to look out for. One of them is if you ever feel that you've had the, quote, worst headache of your life, that's something that has been ingrained in every single medical student's mind that you learn since day one of your clinical rotations. If anybody ever says to you, this is the worst headache of my life, you really have to make sure there's nothing more dangerous going on. Other signs and symptoms: if you pass out with your headache, if you have severe neck tension, although as I said, these are common with migraine, but again, very severe. If you have a fever, if you're having other neurological symptoms such as numbness and tingling, difficulty speaking, these are some of the things that make us really concerned and would like to do more testing. More or less, these are kind of the ones that are jumping out at me at the moment.
So let's change tracks here a little bit and talk about something that seems to be in the newspapers and the magazines every day, and I'm interested in your thoughts on it. It's called attention deficit disorder.
Right.
Is it overdiagnosed? Is it overused in our schools? Are psychiatrists and neurologists overusing it?
I think the answer to that is probably yes. It's tough to say because it's a relatively new diagnostic entity, so we're not really sure exactly if it's being overdiagnosed now or if we have really specific criteria. In other words, we've described the disease so well now that it's easy to categorize people as having ADD or not, or I should say ADHD or not, but your question really sort of...
And the H stands for...
Hyperactivity. Exactly, exactly. Yeah. But your question really speaks to the fact, how can we distinguish somebody who has a problem, such as, you know, called attention deficit disorder, where it's really quite an issue with attention and concentration, and when is it sort of everyday feeling flustered and procrastination, and when do we really draw the line in terms of pathology and just feeling kind of, you know, spacey?
So I guess before we get into what the signs and symptoms are, is this a disease that affects only children, or do we see it in adults as well?
Right.
And can it come on in adulthood and not be present in childhood? Or?
Right. Again, you've really hit the nail on the head, because the deal with ADD is that it's not something that comes de novo. In other words, it is something that has to, in order to have attention deficit disorder, you have to have had these symptoms since before age 7. So it is nothing that you can get as an adult out of the blue. However, it might be diagnosed in adulthood. But when somebody comes to me with a questionable diagnosis of ADD, I have to make sure to really gather a tremendous amount of history from what they were like as a little guy or a little girl, if they really had these symptoms before age 7.
Is it more common in boys or girls?
It is more common in boys, but I have some suspicions about that as well, because girls oftentimes present differently. Yeah. Oftentimes, boys present with the more classic hyperactivity, and girls present more as daydreamy. And they're really not brought to the attention of the teacher or the parent because they're not as much of a behavioral problem.
So help me. You know, I've got 2 young children. What are the signs that I need to look for that should make me suspicious that I need to at least have my child looked at?
Right. So I work more with adults, but I can tell you in terms of children, you really want to look at a child who is having difficulties with behavior in more than one area. In other words, if it's just that they're inattentive at school, but they're fine at home, usually it's not something such as ADD. The behavior has to be somewhat consistent in different areas. So we're looking for children who might have a hard time sitting in their seat, who are very fidgety, who find it hard to do things such as raise their hand in class. They just blurt things out. They're more impulsive. They're getting in trouble more. In addition, we're looking for oftentimes children who are sort of labeled by teachers as being really, really bright, but just can't, quote, get it together, can't follow directions, and for that reason, they're not doing well academically, but the teacher really has a hunch that they're smart, or the parents have a hunch that they're smart. Looking at things such as procrastination, disorganization, and in kids, it's tough because who doesn't have a messy room kind of thing, but if it's really an extreme, and again, we see this in more than one area or more than one division of the child's life, that's when we want to call attention to it.
Yeah, it sounds like you're describing my son. You know?
Well, I think every kid below age 2 has ADD. So.
Yeah. But you mentioned in girls it's a little bit more daydreamy. So how does that get picked up then?
It's tough. It's tough because a lot of times it falls a little bit under the radar because most teachers, you know, they're grappling with a huge classroom and they really just they're drawn towards the child that's causing problems. But really, a lot of times with the girls, they're inattentive. But instead of filling the space with rambunctious and acting out, etc., they're spacing out into the window and really somewhere else. One good thing actually about these days, people say it's overdiagnosed. But at the same time, in my practice, I've seen what happens when somebody isn't diagnosed, and it's actually very, very. It actually can be heartbreaking because kids grow up with the notion that they're stupid, and it just doesn't make sense to them that everyone else is getting it when they're not. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the logical conclusion is, you know, you're just not that bright.
Yeah.
And in many ways, people who come to me in adulthood are victims of their generation because the schools really were not learned in picking these kids out.
Is there a cause for ADD? Did something happen, or is it genetic, or something happened during birth, or...
Right. There's still a number of things that need to be puzzled out. Generally, the answer to that question is probably, but we don't really know for sure. There have been a few studies using actually PET scanning. A PET scan is sort of a fancy camera that looks at the way that the brain uses energy. It's very sort of cool technology. You put somebody into a machine, you image their brain, and you can see which parts of the brain are working more effectively than others. And what we do see from a PET scan is that people with ADD actually have lower levels of glucose metabolism, which is a fancy way of saying that they're utilizing energy poorly in certain areas. So we know that there is something going on with the nervous system and at the really basic neuronal level, at the level of the nerves, which are the cells that make up the nervous system. But there is probably a genetic component. We do see some degree of heritability in that oftentimes people will describe that their parents were ADD-like. But again, because it's a bit of a generational thing, a lot of times their parents weren't diagnosed. So still these studies are really, really the epidemiological studies are lagging.
So when you're dealing with the diagnosis of ADD in a child, Do you find that you spend a lot of time also coping with the parents' anxiety about, oh, what did I do wrong or how did I go bad as a parent?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I really treat adults, but I can tell you that it is so common for parents to really blame themselves for whatever imperfections their children have. And the truth of the matter is every child has imperfections, and you really sort of have to love them all that much more, to be honest, because there really is, you get some things and not others. And you really, you're way ahead of the game if you know what it is that you have and what you don't have. So I really encourage parents not to overreact to a diagnosis when I'm treating adults, really not to overreact in a way of not to minimize it. I mean, it can be upsetting, but at the same time, there's still a tremendous number of treatments for ADD, and they're capable of many things. And again, if you know sort of what your problems are in life, you're ahead of the game.
You treat mostly adults. Mm-hmm. Somebody comes in your office and they're 30 years old. They go, my gosh, I've had this for 30 years. Didn't know it.
Yeah.
What's their first response? They're mad? Are they relieved?
They're pissed. And they're relieved too. I think that because so much of self-esteem and self-image is formed when you're a child. So to feel like you're always behind the eight ball and to really be sort of scratching your head and wondering, why is it so easy for this kid to learn how to read? And I just can't get it together. Wow, I must really be stupid. To really sort of be able to say to someone, no, it's just that your brain works differently, is very reparative to patients.
By and large, are these people, when you get diagnosed as an adult, have they been victims of, feeling that they're stupid, as you said earlier? Mm-hmm. Are they underachievers? Or is there a broad spectrum,
right.
Executives and...
Right.
And
huge spectrum. Huge spectrum. Some people have achieved tremendous objective success, but really feel on some level, a deeper level, low self-esteem because they were, and again, so much of our self-esteem is formed at an early age, that they really weren't able to kind of join in with the other kids and really kind of scratching their heads, why the heck am I not like everyone else? Which is every kid's dream. And essentially, it can be, as an adult, also very upsetting because they were not really able to receive the treatment that can make their lives much easier at an adult age.
So like headache, is this curable?
It is curable. It is, and as I actually back to your last question. So I see a huge spectrum. I see some people that that they're very, very successful and they've really learned how to compensate. And then I see other people that really have not been able to progress in their lives the way that they would have liked to. And in terms of cure, it's absolutely something to treat. You sometimes need to use a whole bunch of tricks, but really oftentimes one of the reasons, again, why I love to treat it is because it's something that I really feel that I can help, either through medication or behavioral strategies or a mixture of both.
Is it a cure or is it just they don't get worse?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's not a cure. It's not a cure. Overall, it's not necessarily something that people get worse. It can kind of show up at different times in life. Actually, what I see a lot of are retirees, because people with ADD do very, very well in structured environments, and they actually thrive if you give them a structure. Otherwise, they really can't create their own. And you begin to really see ADD in certain times in life. One is when people retire, because guess what? They're not going to work every day anymore, and they have all this empty time. They don't know how to fill it, and all of a sudden, chaos ensues. Another time that you might see it is in college, because no longer parents are minding their kids and sort of providing for them the necessary structure. They need to keep their lives together. But at any rate, with regard to the treatment, it's more management of the symptoms.
Okay. So the medicines that you typically mm-hmm. use for this, what are they? What do they do?
So the mainstay of treatment is really the stimulant medications. These are the Adderalls and the Ritalins and the Focalins, etc. And those tend to work on a couple of different chemicals called neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters are really just sort of the way that nerves talk to one another. They use these chemicals called neurotransmitters to communicate. And the two neurotransmitters that seem to be implicated in ADD are dopamine and norepinephrine. So naturally, these medications work on those two chemicals and increase them in the brain. The other kinds of treatment I use are sometimes antidepressants can be very helpful, which is a big thing that I need to disentangle between ADD and depression and anxiety, which can also really have a profound impact on concentration.
So it's not always just ADD, it's ADD plus other psychological disorders.
Absolutely. In fact...
So is it one of those diseases that usually comes as sort of a potpourri, or is it usually more of a clean diagnosis, one disease?
Usually no one's got just one of anything. So oftentimes I'll have someone, although, you know, it does happen. Oftentimes somebody will come to my office convinced they have ADD. And for some reason, actually, it's very interesting. It seems to be sort of more socially acceptable to be suffering from ADD than it is to be suffering from depression or anxiety. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times I'll have, you know, tough guys that come in, Wall Street, some really high power field, just not doing that well at work, feel like they're not concentrating, saying, you know, I have a buddy who takes Ritalin, it's really helping him out. And they'll step into my office and I'll start asking them some questions and really see that there's more of a depression component, more of an anxiety component, and that's what's really impairing their concentration.
Before, you alluded a little bit to, you know, things other than medicine, some tricks.
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, there's a ton of things. What's interesting is that a lot of people feel that certain tasks that, you know, that we take for granted, the organization, keeping a schedule, etc., should really come naturally to people. And in ADD, it's very learned. So I'll have some sessions with patients that literally I'll sit down with them and I'll say, okay, you're going to go into Staples. This is the calendar that you're going to get. I tell people how to prioritize. That's a huge issue with ADD because folks with ADD see a project and get extremely intimidated. They have really no idea how to break it down into parts. I can help them learn how to prioritize so that they can tackle a project instead of just putting it off.
About 7-8 years ago, there was a book that came out by a Harvard professor mm-hmm. called Real Boys. Mm-hmm. One of the hypotheses of the book is that, you know, we're cheating our boys because they're being diagnosed with ADD mm-hmm, mm-hmm. when they're really not. They're mm-hmm. just being normal boys. Mm-hmm. What's your sense of that?
You know, I think that I have a son and he is extremely active, and, you know, on a good day I'm thrilled to run around after him, and on a bad day I'm thinking this kid has ADD. But I think that's true. I mean, I think that we have to be very, very careful of not pathologizing normal behavior. I think we have to be really careful of letting our boys be really active and fidgety and childlike and not say, oh, there's a problem here. We have to let our kids be kids.
So we as parents, I guess, have to defend our children sometimes. Because, again, I mean, according to this
Absolutely.
Book, kids are being overdiagnosed right. in the schools, and right. then they get labeled.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And furthermore, even I think that the big piece is that you really, and I mean, it sounds cliche, but if your kid's got an issue, you got to love them all that much more, because every kid's going to be struggling with something in their life, and sort of how you really deal with that particular issue is going to really reflect the way that they deal with their problems later on.
We have to take a short break. I'm with Dr. Julia Sampton, and we're talking about attention deficit disorder and other neurologic and psychiatric disorders. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and again, I'm with Dr. Julia Sampton, the Assistant Director of the New York Headache Center, who works in New York and maintains an active private practice in both neurology and psychiatry. We've had an interesting conversation thus far about attention deficit disorder, and I wanted to change probably from the one extreme of hyperactivity to the other extreme of depression. First off, could you differentiate for me the difference between somebody that has a, quote, mood disorder versus the diagnosis of depression? What's the difference?
Sure. So, well, truthfully, if you're going to sort of stick to the texts, mood disorder is a big term, and under that rubric is depression and anxiety, etc. But maybe what's very sort of puzzling is how can you distinguish between depression and just a down in the dumps kind of feeling, poor mood. And because all of us have a range of emotions and negative emotions are part of life, when is it something to really be concerned about, or when is it something that could be more serious? Usually with depression, we have a number of symptoms that make it really a specific diagnostic entity, and that implies that it's been going on for a while, say 2 weeks or more, and is people really just aren't enjoying anything. There's a term in psychiatry called anhedonia, which means that you're just not able to get pleasure from anything. You're sleeping very poorly, or some people might sleep all day. You have difficulty concentrating. You might feel sluggish and really not only mentally depressed, but also physically very slowed down. On the other hand, some people feel a little bit physically agitated, one or the other. These are some of the symptoms that really differentiate it from just a regular down-in-the-dumps feeling. And of course, oftentimes feelings that people really think that life isn't worth living and that things just really aren't going to get better. They're really unable to see any sort of optimism on the horizon.
This week in the journal Stroke, there's an article coming out from Australia mm-hmm. where they looked at the incidence of depression after stroke.
Mm-hmm. It's huge.
And I presume patients with brain tumors. Mm-hmm. When do you differentiate, again, between it is true mm-hmm. depression mm-hmm. versus, you know, it's an appropriate mm-hmm. bad feeling mm-hmm. about, listen, I just had a bad event or something bad is going on in my life. It's just right. a mood change.
Right.
You know, how do you differentiate
right.
that?
Right, right. Very good question. And basically, what we really think is that overall, depression really should not be a, quote, natural response to anything. Definitely, we encounter sadness if something bad happens, especially something to do with our own health or the health of others, or experience a tragic event, or even just a life transition. There can be some down feelings, but the specific symptoms that indicate a depression, like some of the ones that I listed, where really you're up all night, you really mind is racing with negative thoughts, feeling life isn't worth living, that you'd be better off dead, that is really not a natural response to any condition.
So is it more common in men or women? Like
more common in women. More common in
women.
Is
there a reason for that?
Well, it's hard to say. Part of it could be there's an interplay with hormones. It could also be that it's more commonly diagnosed in women because it's more socially acceptable in some arenas for women to be more vocal about their feelings. Men, sort of, it's a status symbol almost to have a macho outlook, might not be as accepted to be depressed. Certainly I can tell you that I see many, many, many men who are depressed. And oftentimes one of the things that brings a man into my office is that they have a medical problem that they've gone to see many doctors for and nobody really can find a cause for it. Mm-hmm. Somehow it seems more socially acceptable to have perhaps an ache or a pain or something than to have depression. But depression it's very real, and again, something that can be treated. So it's worthwhile to, if you're having some of these symptoms that really distinguish just a bad mood from a very serious depression, to seek help.
Are there age groups? I mean, is it cut across all age groups, or are there times in our lives when we should be worried about becoming depressed?
That's a great question. There is definitely a peak of depression in the elderly. Often these are folks that obviously experience a tremendous amount of loss and can experience a depression. But otherwise, generally speaking, age from about 18 to 40 is the most common time that we see depression. And lots of times people in their 50s and even in their 60s are not feeling as depressed. But again, along, you know, one individual's lifespan, it's very sort of hard to generalize from these statistics.
And like these other things, the ADD you're talking about, is depression commonly linked with other psychiatric disorders, so it makes it harder to treat?
Not so much that it makes it harder to treat, because conveniently, a lot of the medications that are used to treat other mood disorders are used to treat depression, which is great. Makes my job easier. But oftentimes, if we see a depression with, for example, substance abuse, that's always a little tricky. It's very, very hard to treat depression, anxiety when someone's been drinking, using drugs. That usually is the number one thing to take care of before you can really move on and treat the disorder. Usually that means that somebody's trying to medicate away.
Which comes first, the depression or the person using the drugs?
That's the question, right?
Yeah.
Hard to say.
Yeah. Okay. So what kind of drugs do you use? I mean, are they uppers, or you know, what do you use to help the patient?
So there's been really a revolution in the treatment of depression since, I think it was 1985 when Prozac came out, and that what we think is really implicated in depression is a deficiency, or I should say low levels of what I was talking about earlier, neurotransmitters, which are the chemicals that one nerve uses to talk to another nerve, specifically in serotonin. And serotonin, also, you might see it as 5-HT somewhere, which is sort of the chemical abbreviation for it. It's low in depression. And so most of the medications that we use will increase the rates of serotonin. In addition, these medications work on norepinephrine, which is something that I also mentioned with attention deficit, and dopamine, which is something that I also mentioned with attention deficit. And we have three or four different categories of medications that work either on one or several of these neurotransmitters.
So all in all, do you think depression is a really treatable problem nowadays?
I do. I think that for the most part, it's very treatable. Sometimes it takes, you know, it's really up to the individual in terms of how they want to be treated with medication or with talk therapy, psychotherapy, which is another excellent treatment for depression. Specifically, one kind of therapy has been shown in research trials to be very effective called cognitive behavioral therapy. You know, most of us, when we think about psychotherapy, we think about Freud and going back into the early ages and thinking about what conflicts we experienced as a young person and how that really impacts our adulthood. And certainly that plays a role. But the one treatment that's been shown to be very effective for treating depression doesn't really go back historically to tease out all the parental and early childhood experience. It really focuses on symptoms. And so if somebody is feeling panicked and anxious or depressed, the cognitive behavioral therapy really helps people adjust their mentality and helps them really form coping skills to deal with these feelings.
All the things we've been talking about, you know, in terms of, you know, headaches, depression, attention deficit disorder, the good news is that they all sound eminently treatable, which is
yeah,
great.
Yeah.
How did you get into this field?
Well, I've always been fascinated with the brain and with human behavior. So just something that I've always gravitated towards. I think I've chosen the particular areas that we're talking about tonight because they are treatable, and I'm very, very lucky because I've chosen some fields where I can really fix things versus some other things in medicine which are tough to treat. And so it's such a great joy for me to really be able to practice because I can oftentimes see results. And that, for me personally, is very satisfying. But the intellectual aspect of my work, which is really, I think, addressing some of the, you know, the really basic mysteries of what make us human and mind versus brain and what sort of is chemistry and what's emotion. And these are the kinds of things that I get to think about on a daily basis. And I really also get the privilege of talking to people in a very sort of intimate way and really, really get to see what it's like to be someone else. And for me, that's a great joy.
That's the interesting part about what you do is what of yourself do you end up sharing with the patient?
Yeah.
And how do you not lose yourself in the process of trying to help them?
Yeah. Well, it's tough. I'm constantly trying to answer that question for myself and refine my answer. And quite honestly, it changes. I think that oftentimes I will respond to the patient because some patients really, it's very helpful for them to hear something personal about myself. Most of the time I try to keep it out because I really like to preserve the relationship and make it about the patient. And it's easier, I think, to do that if you just have sort of very rigid rules. Mm-hmm. You don't want to necessarily have your issues ever dovetail with those of your patients. But at the same time, I think that human beings really need support. And oftentimes the easiest way to communicate support to someone else is by being able to say, you know, I've been there. I know what you're talking about.
Was there the difference between, you know, say, a psychoanalysis where the person mm-hmm. really has to mm-hmm. delve into themselves mm-hmm. versus, you know, you're dealing with some behavioral mm-hmm. issues and it, mm-hmm. it allows you the ability
exactly.
to share a little bit more with the patient?
That's definitely one of the reasons why I've read a lot of Freud, and it's fascinating to me. And in fact, where I trained here at Cornell, it's very psychoanalytically based. And it's fascinating, but for me, my natural personality isn't so neutral. And really, as a psychoanalyst, you have to really be neutral. And I had a tough time just shutting up the whole...
So you like happy medicine.
I guess... It's not so much that it's happy because, truthfully, people come to me with a lot of heartbreak. Mm-hmm. But for me personally, I enjoy the fact that, I can help that. I can help you.
Do you have to be a patient person to do what you do? I mean, patient, I come into mm-hmm. you tomorrow and I've got ADD. Mm-hmm. How fast are you going to cure me or mm-hmm. maintain me?
Depends. Really depends. Some people it's just magic. You get it right away. Mm-hmm. And some people it's a lot of different trials. And one of the real challenges of my field is to keep people's trust in me. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times if you give someone a medication and they don't like the way it makes them feel, they might say, you know what, forget this doctor and forget this medication and I'm going right back. And so in order to really support the patient and make them feel that, listen, this one didn't work, but there's about 8 million other things that might. So just trying to hang in there.
What really gets you excited? You know, what in the morning you wake up and say, ooh, I want to go do that.
I really, really do feel that it is an absolute honor sometimes to be in the position that I'm in, where I really get to interact with people in a very profound way. You know, sometimes I really feel that it's just a privilege to really be let into people's private lives. Actually, I had a patient last night who was saying to me that she really appreciated the fact that I was, she could tell so much that I was listening to every single word she said. And, that almost she compared me to a surgeon, that I'm kind of getting in there with a scalpel and trying to sort of tease through all the words that she's saying to try to figure out what's in between. And quite honestly, I was really caught off guard because for me, my job is so engaging that I really don't realize that time is passing. And I also... Because of my the seat that I sit in, I see people who come to me asking for help, who oftentimes are feeling vulnerable. And again, it really is a privilege to be in the situation that they allow me to be present with them in a very human way.
Are these patients vulnerable?
Yeah. Well, everyone is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But these more so than, the average person walking down the street?
I think that they're more in touch with their vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, it's, one of the ironic things is a lot of people who might need it the most never end up in my office. I actually had a supervisor that told me once, and this has always stuck with me, and I tell my patients quite often, and it sounds sort of like a cheesy analogy, but it's always worked, is that, you know, the people who get manicures aren't necessarily the people who have, you know, uglier hands. It's the people that care about their hands. And similarly, the people that come to see a psychiatrist or come into psychotherapy or who are really concerned about their mood and stuff aren't necessarily the people who need it, but it's the people who are concerned the most about their quality of life.
Yeah. We're coming towards the end of the hour, and I was just wondering, what did you personally find were some of the challenges of becoming a highly successful physician in the New York area, particularly in regard to being a woman, a mother, and married, and right. that? What are the challenges you've had?
The juggling act. Yeah. The forever juggling act. It's tough, and I think that especially when there's so much you want to do in life, to try to be able to do it all and really be able to have some fun at the same time. It can be tough. And so I am constantly having a conversation with myself. Am I really spending as much time as I want with my family? And should I, you know, not have this particular interaction or that particular interaction? So it's just the constant juggling act that you have to really maneuver.
You've got two children. Do you spend time talking with them about, you know, I'm busy and, you know, how are we going to adapt?
Yeah, I mean, I have a 2.5-year-old and a 9-month-old. So right now the conversation with the 9-month-old is a lot of goo goo gaga. But the 2.5-year-old, I've sort of just come to the conclusion that if I am not ambivalent about the fact that I work, then hopefully he'll be able to respect that and set a role model for him. Not that I think that actually I've made the right decision for me. Not necessarily it's the right decision. So I try really to just show him that I'm happy with what I do, and I cherish the time that I spend with him, but that overall I really feel blessed that I can bounce between both worlds. That's on a good day. On a bad day, I really just come home and turn on the TV and zone out.
Julia Sampton, Assistant Director of the New York Headache Center, thank you for spending this hour with me. It's been a great pleasure.
Such a pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Dr. Philip Stieg is the chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College and neurosurgeon-in-chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Ken Ipp is our producer. The executive producer is Alan Shartok. Our audio engineer is Adam Claremont. Production support for How to Save Your Life comes from the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. How to Save Your Life is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.